Time now for our monthly media segment, Signals and Noise. One of the things we notice about running a monthly media segment in 2019 is the topics come fast and furious. We could do this daily. We can try to lock up the topics a few days in advance. The avalanche of news frequently buries us right up to the last minute. That's okay. It means there's always plenty to talk about. And we do define media very broadly. We take in items about the media themselves and content delivered over a broad range of media, from virtual reality to books. Our regular guests are here from the communication faculty at Southern Oregon University. Andrew Gay, welcome back.
Thank you.
Chris Lucas back subbing for Precious Yamaguchi this month. Chris, always good to see you.
Thanks.
Let us start more regionally, and this is a news media issue because it's about the resignation of Oregon's public records advocate, a position that's only in existence for 2 years now, and Ginger McCall said she'd had enough. The governor's office is trying to exert too much control and make this more of a governor's office sanctioned kind of thing, and she said, I need to be more independent than that. I wonder what either of you make of what you're seeing there.
There's a lot that's still emerging about this story. It broke pretty recently, and I think there's a lot we don't know. I really agree with the op-ed that was in the Mail Tribune yesterday. I think there's a real loss. Ginger McCall is a fantastic hire in that position. Great experience coming out of the watchdog group Epic, and then also working in the Labor Department.
Yeah, so she's worked on both sides of media.
Exactly. So, you know, I don't quite know, what the nature of this the interference she's talking about. It's I'd like to see more details, but I think one of the root problems here is, you know, how agencies can be independent within the state system, right? So the legislation clearly put this under the governor's office, and we do have agencies that have certain degrees of independence. Think of certainly the attorney general, but then we also know that that becomes fraught very easily. Mm-hmm. And this is only this is only 2 years into this story of this office, and so we'll have to work that out.
I'm glad you mentioned the attorney general, because I did notice a more recent wrinkle that came out apparently yesterday, that there was an attorney general's rendered opinion that said, well, yes, you do answer to the governor's office, you're in the executive branch, but in terms of day-to-day and review of reports, which is the kind of thing some of the governor's staff workers were requesting from Ginger McCall, that's not specified in the legislation.
Right. And I thought it was interesting. I saw online, I think it was yesterday, that David Collier at I think the University of Arizona or Arizona State, one of those. He did some research on transparency in the states, and Oregon is ranked 38th in the country, whereas our neighbors Washington and Idaho are tied for first in terms of government transparency. So Oregon has a lot of work to do, and obviously that's really important for journalism. And I think that, you know, this is a troubling story. I agree with Chris, we don't know all the details yet, but I think it's reason to look very closely. And I'm hoping that, some of the major news outlets will continue to kind of try to get to the bottom of this.
It was a bit of a surprise. Ginger McCall had been on the program just in the last few weeks, and again, was a fantastic guest. I mean, just fully in charge of the doings of her office and the things she wanted to do with it, and very much engaged in making sure that there's as much transparency as possible. There's a great little ironic twist here, of course, in the fact that now there's denial from the governor's office about, I didn't know this was going on. Mm-hmm. So who's got the transparency issue here? This is it's not the last we've heard of this for sure.
It's real loss. I mean, I think we want to push this forward, you know, and do it carefully, because, you know, speaking from a media point of view, the role of journalists in watchdogging the government really relies on public records. Mm. And for a state to be that low in the rankings should send up alarm bells for a lot of people.
Yeah, you don't want to be in the bottom half, bottom third, as it were, for among states for transparency. So not a great thing. This is Signals and Noise on the Jefferson Exchange. Andrew Gay and Chris Lucas from the communication faculty at Southern Oregon University talking about a variety of media events. Let's move on to Sharpie Gate.
Oh, my gosh.
Where do we start with it? One of the things I want to say up front, though, is that the whole discussion about Sharpie Gate and the little extra balloon showing that, yes, the hurricane path might have hit Alabama at some point, it tends to obscure the actual impacts, which are significant. We're talking about a hurricane that essentially parked for 2 days plus over the Bahamas with 185 mile an hour winds. And part of the reason we don't have a complete death toll yet is because the destruction is that complete that it's just hard to find where the bodies are. So there's that going on. And then on top of this, we have this whole ongoing issue, like, why is this so important to people?
I think it's interesting because this is kind of a similar story to the McCall story, right? That here this involves another federal agency that's under the under the executive umbrella, but it should have a certain amount of independence. And there's a lot of question of how much independence there is.
We're talking about the Weather Service, right? Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
So people, there's also a lot of discussion about how the media is covering this, right? And people saying, "Oh, come on, it's a tweet. Let's move on. Why are we still covering this?" But it's not. This is not a story about a tweet, and this is not a story about a Sharpie. It's a story about how a politician tweeted something inaccurate and then has obsessively used the media, including their own Twitter account, but also various federal agencies to cover for the misinformation. And so we now have the chief scientist there releasing a scathing letter saying that the statement sort of siding with the president absolutely broke protocols and did not keep to the scientific standards of the agency. And so it appears that the president did order his chief of staff to do something about this. And I think it's a really big story. It seems like a small story. It seems like, oh, really, are we really going to talk about a tweet and a Sharpie? But I think it's a pretty massive story because, you know, these agencies, again, talking about where do journalists get the information they need to help people in real situations. They get it from reliable agencies that should be giving pure scientific information. And so if journalists covering weather events can't trust that the information they're getting hasn't been filtered through some kind of political eye, that's pretty troubling.
I think there's, you know, a larger story here as well to think about and keep an eye on, which is the way that, you know, politicians are really able to use that adversarial relationship with the press, which is what we want. But if they really, you know, just go hard at that adversarial relationship the way that the president has been very able at doing, then there's a weakness, it seems to me, in the journalistic system that it gets fixated on that, that back and forth.
Right.
And
yeah, then, I see the point. Yeah.
But then we lose, as Andrew says, kind of the root issues and what we should be really talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you're right about the fact that the media relationship with government is supposed to be an adversarial one. They get kind of cozy sometimes, but the fact is that the people in government want the story portrayed a certain way. The people in the media want to get what the actual story is, and those views will differ, therefore adversarial.
Mm. Yeah, I think we want to, you know, to the extent that, you know, really any leader, you know, is making the press the enemy, we should be wary of that, right? We want to be recognizing that the press represents us as citizens, and even if we don't always agree with the points of view of all those journalists and we see the flaws in that system, we can still see that, you know, ultimately they are one of our proxies looking at the government on our behalf.
All right. So to move further down the trail of adversarial relationships between government and media, Andrew Gay and Chris Lucas are here for this month's edition of Signals and Noise. We're talking about there was a Playboy reporter reinstated at the White House as the sons of Donald Trump attacked the Washington Post.
Yeah. So just to, you know, we have good transitions today. Right. It just goes right back to the adversarial question. Right, is that, you know, yes, the press should be taking an adversarial stance, but hopefully the government shouldn't be taking an adversarial stance towards the press, right? That the government should acknowledge the role of the press. And this is, I think, the second time that a White House reporter was ejected from the White House and sued and was reinstated by the courts. It probably won't be the last. You know, this keeps happening where the White House is unhappy with a reporter with their behavior or with their questions or whatever it might be, denies their access, and then they go to court, and the court says, you can't do this. Meanwhile, you know, there's the story of, I believe it was Eric Trump, right? The he shared, you know, there, Fahrenthold, is that his name?
David Fahrenthold.
Yeah. He had been emailing employees of the Trump Organization. And it's this very sort of polite email saying like, hi, you know, you're close to the center of an important organization. If you ever have you need to talk to me, here's how to do so. You can do it on background. It can be confidential. If you have information, you know, just basically basic reporting.
I'm here if you right. want to get a hold of me,
right.
is what it said.
Basically. And so yes. Eric, that obviously got back to Eric Trump, and he tweeted it, you know, basically saying like, this is disgusting. Look at what passes for journalism. Like, oh, you know, journalism 101, you mean? Oh, no. You know, a reporter wants information. How odd.
It was straightforward and polite in the extreme, as a lot of other reporters
have
pointed
out. So it reflected pretty well on the Washington Post versus the Trump Organization. But then, you know, the very next day also, you know, the president again tweeted out attacking the Washington Post. And so this is just kind of a continuation of a story we've seen since this administration took hold.
One thing that's, I think, being lost a bit in what I'm reading about the Brian Karam story is the kind of the root incident there was one of the president's advisors, ex-advisor Sebastian Gorka.
Gorka. Oh, that's right.
They
yeah.
had a confrontation in the Rose Garden during an
event.
That's
right. I forgot about that.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's
yeah.
why Karam mm-hmm. was had his press revoked. But the event that everybody was at was a really strange event where you had the president was welcoming a bunch of media personalities that represented the more right-wing bloggers and conservative media stars,
right,
basically.
Yeah.
So they were kind of on one side of that rope, and then you had the mainstream journalists on the other
covering
side.
Covering the event.
so then Karam, who does – I mean, he seems like a fairly pugnacious guy, but he sort of lobbed some comment across that, you know, that metaphorical line to – other people, and then Gorka came to their defense, and it became this confrontation. So, I mean, even the setting in which that story emerges kind of shows this White House's funny relationship with the media.
A gathering of the pugnacious, and when somebody gets pugnacious back, they get kicked
exactly.
out. I see the point there. Yeah, this is Signals and Noise on the Jefferson Exchange. Chris Lucas and Andrew Gay from the Communication Faculty at Southern Oregon University back with us once again. You want to throw your 2 cents worth in? Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Media Lab at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, had some money from Jeffrey Epstein, who, of course, is both disgraced and dead. and somebody had to quit over this. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So, well, first of all, the MIT Media Lab is not necessarily what you might think it is. You know, it kind of conjures up like a journalism think tank or something. It's actually somewhat opaque. I feel like trying to fully understand the kinds of things they're engaged in is a little bit like contemplating the sound of one hand clapping. It's a very eclectic research organization. But yeah, they've been taking money from Epstein for quite a while. Long after it was already known that this man was a pedophile and just a pretty terrible person, and there were people who were complaining about this for quite a while and being ignored, and so it really wasn't until the New Yorker article that came out that finally pushed the issue to sort of public light and forced the executive director to resign over it. But I think we'll still be looking more at this situation because there appears to be a lot of other people who were engaged who knew what was happening and sort of turned a blind eye to it.
My sense is that this wasn't necessarily in the New Yorker article, but several months ago, Ethan Zuckerman, who's a highly respected researcher out of MIT and a member of the Media Lab, had left. And it was quite surprising. And he kind of brought some emails and some other information with him that made that organization less opaque. And my sense is that maybe that was the breaking of a dam and a lot of other information came out. You know, I've been following this with some interest because I know – I don't know how many if you guys saw the Lawrence Lessig defense of the Media Lab, but Lawrence Lessig, who's a very respected sort of thinker and legal scholar around cyberspace issues, wrote a pretty controversial op-ed where he said, well, I'm glad there, you know, this was tainted money, but it was being used for good reasons, basically. This was his argument, which was then roundly criticized by a lot of people. But I think it did raise an interesting question just about nonprofits and the nonprofit sector and how, you know, these organizations that really do need financing, and a lot of them, as certainly state and government funding is falling and it's getting harder to raise money, they're willing to accept donations, and especially if they're anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is a debate about, well, you know, where's that line? You know, how much do you ask of the donors who are supporting you? To what extent are you allowing them to sort of whitewash their reputations? If it's anonymous, are you kind of avoiding that problem? I think most people are in agreement that, you know, Epstein, even though it was quote unquote anonymous, he was not being anonymous about it. He was also out as a public face.
Okay.
But it still is, I think, an interesting question and thing for us to think about, the problem of anonymous donations and how we support these organizations that do a lot of good work.
All right. So there's a fair amount of nose-holding, it sounds like, about the people you take money from. Let's move on in the Signals and Noise to talk about the New York Times 1619 Project, which is about the 400th anniversary of the first slaves coming to British North America in Virginia in 1619. So here we are 400 years later talking about it. I have seen more criticism than I've read the actual pieces myself, Andrew.
Yeah, there's been a lot of criticism, particularly, I would say, from sort of the conservative end of the political spectrum. You know, people saying that, you know, that this project sort of seeks to, I think I've seen the phrase weaponize history to kind of get us all, you know, down on America. I have the pieces I've seen in it, I think, have been pretty remarkable, though. I mean, it's an eclectic range of works from a lot of different kinds of authors and thinkers about, you know, what does it really mean that this country really was founded in so many ways on slavery, and you know, what is that hidden history that we we all acknowledge, oh yeah, slavery was there, but let's not think too much about it because it's gone now. And so I thought it was pretty powerful, that what I have seen of it. I think that the reactions are sometimes telling when people get so angry about it, and it's like, well, this is history, you know, let's acknowledge it.
Yeah, the lead essay by Nicole Hannah-Jones is a beautiful piece of writing. Yeah. I'll recommend that to anybody. To kind of, I guess, get meta a little bit, I've been really impressed with how carefully thought out that whole project was. I mean, it was a very sort of deep and complicated set of essays and writing and thinking in the paper, but then there was also a podcast, and then there was producing educational materials to make freely available to schools. So this is a really interesting multimedia project, and both gets into how, you know, a paper like the New York Times, which clearly at this point is beyond just being about New York, is this national, international newspaper, in its desire to survive, is kind of reaching out and trying to find new ways to serve the public and create a business around sharing information.
Including the half-hour show, The Daily, that we have here on the News and Information Service, 1:30 in the afternoon, if you're curious. yeah, it's been interesting to watch the responses to the 1619 Project, and I guess I come back to the fact that my wife grew up in the South, so we actually still have one of her history books, No Alabama, and it wasn't this edition that we have at home, but a later edition that included the words, when a slave owner got out of bed in the morning, the first thing he thought about was if his slaves are okay and if they're being treated well.
Yeah, I mean, I also grew up in the South, and, you know, at a different period, and yet I was still, you know, I still always grew up around people who said, yeah, slavery was bad, but, you know, a lot of the slave owners were nice, and a lot of the slaves were pretty happy, and you know, that was still kind of a perspective. In the 80s, right?
Uh-huh.
So it's, you know, so I really think that this, I recommend the piece to anyone. Again, it's more than one piece. It is a kind of this really fun, not fun, but It's very interactive. It's it's very engaging. A collection of media. So I would recommend it to anyone.
Yeah, the interactivity pieces on both the New York Times and the Washington Post have gotten very impressive in the last couple of years. All right, we're not going to get a chance to talk about Brexit. Oh, darn it. And how Americans talk about it. Order!
I don't know what's happening.
Right. So so let's move on to the final 2 minutes and a pick three from each of you. And Andrew, why don't you go first?
All right. Well, this weekend is the Klamath Independent Film Festival in Klamath Falls.
Yeah, tomorrow.
So I'm heading over for that. There's lots of local film. The Klamath Independent Film Festival is Oregon's only festival that is geared only towards Oregon and Northern California filmmakers. So if you want to see some film from people you might know or you see in the grocery store, come out to that. I've been interested in a new album out by a group called The High Women. It's sort of a take off the old Highwaymen with Johnny Cash and Willie Nelson and all that. It's a group of country women singers. Their first single is a cover of The Highwaymen, but rewritten to tell feminist stories, which is pretty awesome. But the thing I'm really excited about is Dark Crystal: Age of Resistance, which is a new Netflix series based on the Jim Henson film Dark Crystal, which is kind of an obscure cult classic. But the series is a prequel, and even if you're not into fantasy, even if you're not into puppets, I mean, it is just one of the most remarkable works of art I've ever seen. I mean, there is not a frame of that show that your jaw is just not on the floor, thinking, how in the world do people do that with puppets? It's just a really a beautiful work of art.
Okay, Chris, you took most of your time. You got
Sorry.
About 40 seconds.
Oh, okay. Well, I know a lot of fans of music noticed yesterday that the songwriter Daniel Johnston passed away yesterday. I recommend a great documentary about him from 2005 called The Devil and Daniel Johnston. Also recommend for a piece of just pop culture pleasure that is about media, the Succession show on HBO.
Right.
Highly recommended. And if you really care about this Public Record Advisory Council issue we started out with, tomorrow at 3:30, if you go to the Secretary of State website, there's going to be a live meeting streamed with Ginger McCall, kind of talking about what went down.
Thank you for bringing that to our attention. Okay, 3:30 tomorrow with the Secretary of State's website, the Public Records Advisory Council, Ginger McCall, explaining why she's leaving. Andrew Gay, Chris Lucas from the Communication Faculty at Southern Oregon University, thank you for Signals and Noise.
Thank you.
Thank you.